This is the What Matters Most podcast. A 100% listener-supported program. And now, here is your host, Paul Samuel Dolman.
Welcome back to What Matters Most. Happy holidays to everybody. God, we're already into January 2022. Surreal at times. Appreciate all the feedback, the great guest suggestions, the people who write in and share their stories. Special shout out to the Patreons who support the show. Thanks so much. Some for five, some for 50. Doesn't matter. It's listener supported. Appreciate the love. Thank you to Matthew Wayne Selznick, our technical genius, who actually had to solve some serious issues last week. Sorry about that, but it wasn't his fault. And we are excited about today's guest. God, what an important book and topic. He is a law professor, and he has written a book called Why Privacy Matters. He asked some wonderful questions in this. I really dove into it. It was a very easy read, very provocative. It's an honor to welcome to the show for the first time, Mr. Neil Richards. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
I always like to ask now, here we are almost in year three that is starting. How have you done over the last two with COVID? How has it affected you, especially as a teacher?
It's been a challenge as a teacher, as a parent, as a human being. This is going to be the third academic year that will have had some COVID effects. But we went virtual fairly quickly in March 2020 at Washington University, where I teach. We had essentially a largely virtual academic year for 2021. And then last fall, we were back in the classroom. I had a class of 83 students in privacy law. We were in masks. We were vaccinated. But now with Omicron, we're virtual again for a couple of weeks, and we'll see. But it's definitely require resources and adaptability and persistence and optimism.
Have you ever had any periods of just collective and sort of a fatigue, I should say, not so much a collective fatigue, but a long-term fatigue?
I think everybody has. I think I'm lucky as a law professor that a lot of my job can be done from a home office. I already have one set up. We can, obviously, virtual education is not nearly as good as being in person. But at least for graduate students, which is what I teach, we can deliver a reasonable facsimile of it. I have an enormous degree of sympathy and empathy for kindergarten teachers and grade school teachers and high school teachers, as well as for parents of kids who are too young to get vaccinated or too young to understand. Our kids are teenagers. They're in high school and college. And it stinks for them. But I think it's important, you know, when you go through these sorts of situations to be grateful for what you have, and to look on the bright side of things and try to be optimistic. But yeah, total exhaustion and burnout and fatigue. And I think we're all tired of this, but you know, we got to do our best to persevere.
How have your kids coped?
You know, reasonably well. We had one in middle school, one a junior in high school when this all hit. Now we have one in the middle of high school and one who started college. So it's difficult starting a new school where things are virtual or where everybody's in masks or you can't really hang out with your friends the same way. It's difficult going through a college search and virtual college visits and applications and then moving in. But you know, all is well. No complaints. We're very lucky. We'd just like this to be over.
Amen. Amen. How did you find your way so deeply into the world of privacy and privacy matters?
That's a great question. I'm almost 50. So I've been a law professor for about 20 years. When I was in law school, I was interested in civil liberties and technology and legal history. And I was lucky enough to be able to do a postdoc in 2000 after I finished law school and clerking for some judges. And a book arrived this is back in the days when publishers would just send out copies of casebooks and textbooks to law professors to try and get them to adopt them. And it was called Information Privacy Law. And I realized, I just sat with it for a couple hours. in my office, and just realized that this was so many things that I was interested in. Both, you know, the wonder of computers, which this is 2000, so the internet was relatively new. I've been interested in computers for about 20 years at that point, and knew they were going to be big, but I was also worrying about some of the threats that they pose to things we might care about. And privacy seemed to pull so many of these interests together. How do we take advantage of these amazing digital technologies, but at the same time, how do we stop them from destroying journalism and destroying political deliberation and spreading misinformation? That's a little ahead of where we were in 2000, but I was concerned about government surveillance. I was concerned about corporate data collection. I was concerned about the relationships between the two. So I decided when I became a professor, I was going to write at first a couple of articles about privacy, and pretty much exclusively that's what I do now.
And is privacy in general and its importance misunderstood? Feels like it is.
Yeah, of course. There's a lot of misconceptions about privacy. I go into a lot of them in the book. I think I want to say two things about misconceptions about privacy. One of them is privacy and talk about the death of privacy or privacy being dying. These are our way of discussing anxiety about changes in technology, about exposure, about the social power that information gives. And Americans have been talking a lot about the death of privacy or privacy dying since the birth of the internet. But you know what? They've been talking about the death of privacy since the 1890s. If privacy is dying, it's one of those long drawn out Bugs Bunny, goodbye cruel world, final scene of Hamlet, deaths that takes forever to come about. Because I think we express anxiety about privacy dying, but it really is our way of expressing our anxiety about these changing social norms about human information and the changing power dynamics that the changes in how we think about and process and access human information are playing out. That the second thing about misconceptions about privacy is that once we realize that privacy is about power, about the power that human information confers, we see a whole bunch of lower level misconceptions about privacy. So the idea that we should think about privacy in terms of having nothing to hide, or that privacy about the best way to think about privacy is whether something is creepy or not, or the way to solve privacy problems is to give people better control of their information. As I explained in the book, all of these are misconceptions, just as much as the misconception that privacy is dead or that it's dying.
And why is it so essential? I know, but I want to ask you.
Why does privacy matter?
Yeah, why does it matter so much? And especially, in my opinion, for democracies, civilization to flourish, artistic people to be able to grow, pluralism, equality, justice.
Yeah, privacy matters not just because information is about power and human information confers power over human beings, but privacy enables us to get so many things that we care about. It lets us develop our identities as human beings, lets us figure out who we are and what we believe. Privacy allows us to develop our roles as citizens and to engage in the democratic process and also to be free from Cambridge Analytica style electoral manipulation through the use of targeted ads and highly refined, highly persuasive political advertisements that appeal to our personalized psychologies. Privacy matters because it protects us as consumers against companies and other entities that would seek to manipulate or trick or influence us or expose us based upon things they know about what we look at online, even relatively benign things like our interest in shoes. the more information you can have about someone, the better you can predict what they're going to do, the better you can influence them. And if we care about our autonomy, our authenticity as humans, as citizens, and as consumers, given the importance of human information, given the power that human information confers, particularly when coupled with advances in information technology and behavioral science, we have to care about privacy. That in it, we're entering, as I say in the at the very end of the book, we're in an information society, and an information society, privacy is the whole ballgame. It's what allows ourselves, our politics, and our economy to flourish. And if we care about protecting people in an information society, we need to care about privacy.
I agree, because I think it's fundamental to being human. Your every thought shouldn't be known and exploited so that you buy things or that you're taken into custody because you considered a certain political position. How can you live like that?
Well, I don't think you can. I think, you know, and we have really good cultural touchstones for government surveillance. We don't have as good sense of touchstones for commercial surveillance because it's a relatively newer problem. But if you think about obviously 1984, Bentham and Foucault's Panopticon, but even movies, you know, like The Lives of Others. I don't know if you've seen this film. It's about a German Stasi officer who's surveilling a suspected dissident, and it looks at things from his perspective. But it shows the not just the importance of privacy, but how unscrupulous powerful entities, in this case totalitarian governments, can use what they learn about you to embarrass you, to discredit you, to influence you. It's interesting when people who've studied failing democracies or rising autocracies, right, possibly something we should always be on guard for, but maybe even more so given recent events. Political opponents of the regimes, I think you know, Putin's Russia here, they're often not prosecuted for opposing the regime. They're prosecuted for or undermined because of information that is learned about them, because of vulnerabilities that are exposed or that are used by unscrupulous entities to blackmail them. That's another. I mean, obviously, blackmail isn't the only reason we should care about privacy. We can be controlled and coerced and manipulated by just large amounts of ordinary information about us. But when we think about vulnerabilities, I think we should worry about the ways in which not just information gets collected, but how it gets used as well. And as a lawyer, as a law professor, I'm interested in remedies, in laws, in constraining harmful and abusive and inappropriate ways that human information gets used.
You mentioned that incredible movie, which was one of my favorites, won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. Reading your book, I kept reverting back to the Orwell classic 1984.
Of course. I mean, when we think about surveillance, Orwell is the first place we look. And when we're concerned about, you know, rising autocracy, then the bleak world that Orwell paints in 1984 of Big Brother, of telescreens on every corner looking at everyone all the time and people never knowing whether they're going to be watched, it's harrowing, the story that he tells. But I think we can't just think about Orwell, right? Because yes, totalitarianism is a concern, but most of the innovation that is going on with respect to personal information is happening from corporations, and we lack the same cultural vocabulary for thinking about corporate power that we do for thinking about government power. We also, as lawyers, we lack the same legal vocabulary, right? The Bill of Rights protects us against exercises of government power, we don't have an equivalent protection against manipulation by advertisers or by technology platforms or by our employers or other powerful private actors in our lives. And I think as we think about building protections for privacy across the board for the 21st century, we need to take the problem of corporate power seriously.
Are you concerned in the moment about our democracy and the encroachment of fascism and autocratic bad faith actors?
I'm a law professor who studies civil liberties. I'm always concerned about these things. Let me say this. I grew up in the north of England, and the north of England was the first place in the world to industrialize. And industrialization was great. It gave us lots of things, cheap textiles and clothing and housewares and cars and airplanes and electricity. But it also produced unsafe working conditions and pollution and dangerous automobiles that we had to bring in check. The other thing that industrialization produced, and we often forget this, is it produced communications technologies that helped contribute to the two great world wars of the 20th century. That was another time when innovative technology disrupted things. And I worry, yes, about political and social and economic destabilization that comes from the information revolution, as well as some of the political effects of that. In turbulent times, people want to hang on to what they have or what they think they had, and they can turn to leaders offering simple solutions. Now, ironically, privacy matters here as well, because information about voters can be used to manipulate, to deliver perfectly crafted political messages in ways that the demagogues of the 20th century, the Hitlers, the Mussolinis, the Father Coughlins could only dream of doing. And I think that's what we saw. The Cambridge Analytica scandal is one of those things that most people have heard of, but few people really understand. And I think if we care about democracy, we need to understand it. What happened in that case was a British psychological warfare company with ties to right-wing politicians, the Mercers and Steve Bannon was among them. Basically stole a whole bunch of data from Facebook through a quote fun personality test, and they use that to construct psychologically validated highly detailed profiles of voters. And because it was Facebook, they got them according to their real names, and they also used that the access they had through Facebook to find out everything that those people could see on Facebook, and then use that observation and machine learning to construct psychological profiles of all of their friends. So for about $1 million or something, they got finely crafted psychological profiles of maybe 100 million American voters, and they used both in America and in Britain, where they also deployed it, they used it to deliver finely crafted ads based upon the personal psychology of the people they were sending them to, in favor of the Leave movement or side of the Brexit referendum in 2016, and the Trump presidential campaign. Regardless of one's politics, I think if we care about the integrity of our elections, if we care about the integrity of our political decision making, then we have to care about privacy. Because it's human information developed through these platforms or exfiltrated from these platforms that was used to try and influence and may well have influenced the outcome in those political decisions we would hope would be autonomous and have real integrity. That personal data is creating a challenge to democracy at a number of different levels. And for better or for worse, privacy is the word we have settled on to group these problems together and to try to deal with them.
I'm sure you saw the other movie, Social Dilemma, which just was incredibly disturbing. And I see Facebook as a very dishonest, bad actor who is damaging democracies and human relationships around the world. And they keep getting caught lying about it. I'm just shocked. I guess they have so much money. I'm really shocked that there hasn't been any criminal consequences so far.
Right. Well, you know, in the Cambridge Analytica case, Facebook received a $5 billion fine. I mean, that's the largest fine the Federal Trade Commission has ever imposed. Now, Facebook's stock price went up the next day. So maybe $5 billion was not the right amount by an order of magnitude. I think the problem with companies like Facebook is they make their money not by charging a service the way Netflix or HBO or a newspaper does. They make their money by selling our attention to advertisers and selling our attention to advertisers in ways that make us more likely to buy things because these platforms know a lot about us, and so they can craft more persuasive, or as they say, more relevant ads. I think the problem, though, is if engagement is the goal, which is what the term Facebook uses for the amount of time you spend on the service. If we're optimizing for engagement, we're not optimizing for, in politics, tolerance or rationality or decency or an citizenry. We're optimizing for what's going to keep people looking and clicking. And very often it's extreme things, political misinformation, vaccine misinformation, outrage about how bad the other side is. I really do think that a lot of our digitally mediated political polarization has been worsened, maybe even caused, but has been worsened by the digital revolution. And I think the problem is we have these business models that we allow through law, actually because we require publicly traded corporations to maximize their profits. We actually, if they're legal, we encourage them through law, and they're bad for us as humans. They're bad for us as consumers. They're bad for us as citizens. They're bad for our democracy. And I think you're right. This, when a company enables electoral tampering at that scale, typically you would imagine there would be certainly, you know, criminal sanctions, but at a minimum, changes in the leadership of those corporations. And normally when the Federal Trade Commission finds a company that has misbehaved in that way, part of the settlement, they insist on new leadership. And the Federal Trade Commission voted narrowly, 3 Republican commissioners to 2 Democratic commissioners, to allow Facebook to keep its governing structure with you know, Zuckerberg and Sandberg and those folks in charge. That perhaps was not the right decision.
Well, it hasn't slowed them down. So that's why I would say that's not the right decision. You know, they seem unrepentant. So, if you gave somebody probation and they kept breaking the law, robbing banks, you would put them in jail then.
You would think. I mean, I think part of the problem here, though, is Congress. Except for the United States, every single advanced economy in the world has a comprehensive privacy statute. Europe has the famous GDPR. Canada's had one for 20 plus years. Argentina has one. Brazil has one. South Korea has one. Even China recently passed a comprehensive commercial privacy statute, putting the Chinese government to one side for a moment. Congress had a chance in 1974 when it passed the Privacy Act, in the wake of Watergate, to regulate commercial data, and it didn't. Congress had a chance in the dawn of the internet to regulate commercial data, and it didn't. And every few years, there's new calls to do this, and Congress has assiduously failed to pass a basic privacy law. And that's been the case when Republicans have controlled Congress, when Democrats have controlled Congress, when there have been various permutations of shared governance between the two main political parties. Congress has failed to check these business models, and they bear a lot of the blame too, because I have no deep love for Facebook in particular, but they are trying to make money, and as a publicly traded company, they have a legal obligation to make money. And if there are lucrative business models that are allowed by the law, that are encouraged by the law, when the law encourages companies to make money to increase their value for their shareholders, then we shouldn't be shocked when companies actually do this. I think better enforcement is needed, but I also think better laws to enforce are needed as well. I think the Federal Trade Commission, who's the principal regulator here in the US, they have done the best they can with a limited set of tools that date back to 1914, from the Industrial Revolution, to deal with these information age problems.
Neil, here's an overly simplistic question, but I'm sure someone's out there thinking it. What exactly is privacy, and how would you define it as a privacy expert?
I think it's a great question. It's a question you would be reasonable to demand from a law professor offering a book about what privacy matters, why privacy matters. What is it? So in the book, I say two things. I say first, we need privacy means a lot of things for a lot of people. So I offer a working definition of privacy, which is just the degree to which our human information isn't known and isn't used. But I think rather than focusing on defining privacy, if we think about human information, we should think about privacy in terms of the rules that govern how that information gets collected and how it gets used. Because rules are what we use to constrain power, and privacy, as I've suggested, privacy questions, privacy struggles, privacy scandals are fundamentally about power. So I think we should think about human information. We should think about the rules governing our human information, and we should think about what those good rules should look like. And in the book, I argue we should, at the risk of becoming very academic for about 10 seconds, we should think about those rules, as a philosopher would say, instrumentally. We should think about privacy rules in terms of what they get us. And I think what good privacy rules can get us is protection of our ability to develop our identities, protection of our ability to exercise political freedom, to figure out our politics, to debate and deliberate and vote in free elections that have integrity. And privacy gets us our ability to be protected as consumers, through what I think should be a new wave of consumer protection law, focusing on human information and the power that human information gives to the companies and the governments that can deploy it.
And surveillance capitalism is a multi-billion dollar business now. It needs to be regulated like any capitalistic business.
Oh, absolutely. Because, I want to be clear, my book is not a screed against capitalism. I'm a moderate. I believe in balance. I think capitalism does some good things. It certainly produces efficient aggregations of wealth. But I think the problem is you need to have capitalism in balance with public oversight. That was the lesson of the robber barons of the Gilded Age. Unchecked capitalism sort of eats society and creates gross inequalities of wealth and power. I think what we need to do is to take advantage of the way the corporate organization can generate value, can produce complex organizational things like a movie studio or a car company or an airline. Or a search engine, but also to to keep that competition within limits. Fundamentally, right, we should have laws, we should build our society to protect people and to let people live their lives in ways that are free and authentic and autonomous and have meaning. And I think one in which we're at the mercy of corporate power, that we're just able to be manipulated and tricked, that we have to spend, you know, all this time worrying about our data security or our passwords or our privacy preferences is not a vision of a good society. So I think, you know, we need to have some sensible rules that take some of these dangerous applications of human information off the table.
How would that speech go over at the NSA?
Well, it probably, you know, I think about other famous speeches that have been given at the NSA in the last 5 years. It probably wouldn't be the least favorite speech in the history of the NSA. But at the same time, I think, you know, so let's talk about national security. The goal of spies, of national security professionals, is to keep the country safe and to advance the national interest. The way the goal of police is to prevent and investigate crime and bring people who've broken the law to justice through the court system. I think you need to have a set of rules that allow public servants, whether they're, you know, police on the beat or analysts at the NSA or CIA, to do their job of protecting national interests zealously, but also to do so within the rules of the game, where the game is democratic control of security institutions. So yes, you know, I'm not saying we shouldn't have government surveillance. I'm not saying we shouldn't have wiretapping, but we require things like warrants and legal process before information can be obtained. We require judges interposed between the security and police agencies and the people. I think as well, we need substantive limits. So you know, we are rightfully outraged when police take the law into their own hands and murder suspects who they believe are guilty. We take that off the table, right? We bring those, we make it illegal, and people who break that law, we bring them to justice. When it comes to organizations like the NSA, I think secret surveillance should be illegitimate because it is just too powerful. It can be used in ways that are deeply corrosive of democracy. So two examples. One, I think I talk about both of them in the book. In the 1960s, the FBI was surveilling Martin Luther King because they believed he was a communist. And they honestly believed that was the reason he was trying to break America's social structure. So they put him under surveillance and they listened to all his phone calls and saw who he was meeting with. They found out he actually wasn't a communist. He wasn't working for the USSR. The reason he was trying to subvert America's social structure was he believed that you know, the system of a racial apartheid known as Jim Crow was an offense to his ethical, philosophical, and religious beliefs. And he was sincerely trying to advocate for social change that way. But they did find out he was having an affair. And they sent him a letter, essentially blackmailing him, saying — they obviously didn't send it on FBI stationery. But it said, you know, King, we know what you're doing. We know who you're with. Take the honorable way out. In other words, kill yourself, or we will expose you. And we will undermine your credibility, and it will destroy your movement. King was murdered before — shortly after he received the letter. So, but that's an example of the power that unconstrained government surveillance produce, even in a democracy like the United States. Another one is recently in South Korea. The South Korean intelligence service decided the national interest would be much better served with candidate A over candidate B. And they used techniques of information warfare, you know, sort of like Cambridge Analytica, to try and ensure that candidate A remained in power, and candidate A did remain in power and became the South Korean leader. And the scandal came to light, and the intelligence service at a minimum had to apologize and to atone and make up for its subversion of democracy. I'd like to think that that was well meaning. They really did believe the national interest was served by having that candidate in office. But it's not in a democracy. It's not for the FBI. It's not for the South Korean intelligence service. It's not for the NSA to make that call. So we need to take certain kinds of abuses of the power that information provides off the table. So that's what I think we need to do.
Richard, what are your personal feelings about Edward Snowden? Do you see him as a hero?
That's a great question. So I reserved judgment on Edward Snowden. Snowden revelations happened in June of 2013. I reserved judgment for several years because I didn't know. I didn't know if he was working for a foreign power. I didn't know if he was seeking fame. I didn't, you know. But I've given Snowden's case a lot of study over the years. I've read all the books by Greenwald, and I've read Snowden's book. I actually had the opportunity to meet him a few years ago and had a really interesting conversation with him. My views on Snowden is that he is a heroic figure, that he was a lifelong Republican. He came from a inside the Beltway, maybe just outside the Beltway, family that had generations of public service in the intelligence community, in the military, in the federal government more generally. He had this very deep view of the importance of democracy, and he's what he saw going on in the NSA after 9/11. The scope of surveillance that was happening in the name of the public, in the name of of public safety, but which was, you know, being withheld from the citizenry, was an affront to the principles of self-government that in his mind, the American Revolution had been fought over. And so that's what he had a pretty comfortable life, living in Hawaii, working for a contractor, making a ton of money, even though he had basically just a high school education formally. He, in his mind, I have no doubt that it was an act of patriotism to bring the information to the public and to do so responsibly through the filter of journalists at The Guardian and The Washington Post, the way Daniel Ellsberg had taken the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times and The Washington Post a generation before. And so that's what motivated him, out of patriotism. And I think that he ultimately provided a valuable public service in bringing these facts to the American public, that prompted a conversation about digital surveillance, about the power of government surveillance, about what limits we should place on government surveillance that burned for many years and is still continuing to this day, you know, almost 9 years after he came forward, and he still lives in Russia, in exile, 9 years later.
I have a similar view. I see him as a hero. And you mentioned one of my all-time heroes, the great Daniel Ellsberg, who his truth-telling, the Pentagon Papers, helped shift the Vietnam War because people were being lied to. And one of the adages when I often hear is, if you have nothing to hide, why aren't you transparent? I like to take out a mirror and point that back at these powerful agencies. Let's have transparency in both directions. Because if whether it's the Gulf of Tonkin or weapons of mass destruction, let's see everything in the light of day. And if it holds up and it's true, well, then there we go. We can have an honest debate. That's what real democracy is. That's what a healthy civilization looks like.
It's interesting that the NSA has, and the NSA, to be fair, the NSA's supporters as much as the agency itself, but certainly its leadership and its supporters have pushed the argument that we shouldn't be as hung up on privacy, and that if you have nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear. At the same time, as you point out, the NSA loves secrecy. You know, it shrouds its operations in layers of technical and legal and operational secrecy and security. And I think what the NSA knows, and this is a point that I make in the book, and I think it's a really important one, is that privacy is about power. If you can do something secretly, sometimes you can do things that are important, or you can also get away sometimes with things that are bad. If we allow scrutiny of human activities, it's an exercise of power to be able to see what's going on. This is why we have the Freedom of Information Act. And so privacy has, and secrecy and information have these power effects. The NSA realizes this. And I think the challenge for privacy law, for our democracy, is to have the right blend of secrecy when it's warranted, privacy when it's warranted, and publicity and scrutiny when it is warranted. And I think we need to use, you know, human values and democratic values to help us to determine when we want privacy and when we don't. But notice that's a far cry from the claim that privacy is dead. You know, the NSA might want to advance that argument, but it certainly would never advance that argument when it comes to public oversight of its activities. And I think that's perhaps the most obvious rejoinder to this idea that privacy is dead. Privacy is not dead. It's not dying. Information is power, and privacy is power. And privacy is up for grabs.
Will we ever have privacy if we walk around with an iPhone in our pocket that tracks every movement? And this was a true story. I was sitting with a friend at lunch, and I mentioned to him that I was thinking about buying an electric bike. I'd never done a search on anything. And when I opened my Facebook or whatever, an hour later, there were ads for electric bikes. And I showed him, and he said, "It's a coincidence." I said, "No way. They are listening." And I like to make a joke that I would say to, I'll say to Siri, "You're not spying on me, are you? You're not listening." And, "No, sir, I'm not." "Okay, see, I didn't think so."
So I would say that you're with respect and affection, you're both wrong. They weren't listening to you, but it wasn't a coincidence. And so a lot of people, and I talk about this in the book too, a lot of people have experienced the phenomenon where they're talking with someone about something and then they get served an ad immediately or a very short time afterwards. I do not believe, based upon my research, that Amazon Alexa, that Siri, that Facebook are listening to you through the microphone of your phone and serving you ads on that basis for two reasons. First of all, it would be a felony for them to do so under a law called the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. This is the law that was at issue. If you've seen the TV show The Wire, this is the Title III that they're talking about getting all these wiretap orders against the drug dealers. The second reason that they're not listening to you is they don't need to. They don't need the audio recording in order to serve you the ad. They know from web surfing, from lifestyle factors, even if you've not search for an electric bike. Maybe you've read articles about them, or even if you've not done that, they can put together using big data and analytics a profile of you as a consumer, and comparing you to other consumers they know about. They will know that someone who meets a series of criteria is the kind of person who might be interested in an electric bike, who might want to buy an electric bike. Or a Peloton, or a fitness machine, or a gym member, or whatever it is. And so it's not a coincidence, because there's a lot of privacy violative data rich processing of information going on about you to serve you those ads. But it probably didn't come from the microphone. It came from all the other data that is collected about you from your phone and your laptop and your tablet. What you do, where you go, who you are, who you live with, who your friends are, and algorithms, you know, very, very valuable algorithms have been created that are very good at crunching the data about what you might be interested in, or if we use this technology in politics, how you might be able to be persuaded to either buy an electric bike or vote for candidate X, or at least be disgusted by candidate X's opponent, so you won't vote at all and your vote gets suppressed. These are the same technologies. And that's why I think if we're interested in privacy, we need to look, if we're interested in democracy, we need to look at both public and private sector uses of human information, because they're related, because the technologies are the same, and because very often the information, the human information flows very readily from public to private sources, whether it's through things like the NSA or search warrants or the government buying data, or corporations looking at information in public records, in voter rolls, in census data, in other kinds of court records or publicly available databases. We just don't have enough rules, and we don't have the right kinds of rules to make some of these shocking and in many cases abusive or manipulative uses of human information to take them off the table.
Well, it was a heck of a coincidence because it was just a few minutes after, but I know what you're saying, because if I do Google anything and do research, I'm bombarded by ads. Like I looked up some golf clubs and then all I saw was ads for golf clubs across several platforms within a few minutes. So that I know for a fact.
Yeah, that's a known business practice of the ad industry. I don't know if it was pioneered, but certainly has been refined by Google, which has a large share of the third-party ad delivery market. That's called retargeting. And the idea is, if we know that from a website that Paul is interested in product X, then we're gonna bombard him with ads for product X. And everyone, I'm sure everyone who's listening has had this experience where they've looked at something online, a product, and they've received a weirdly specific ad in a totally different context, maybe on a different device, for that ad. And that's big money. And you know, companies argue that more relevant ads are better. And I don't think that's the case. I think that we didn't build the internet for more relevant ads. We built the internet, at least as I remember from being around in the mid-90s, for human access to information, for human flourishing, for culture, for connection, for communication, for a better future. And I don't think we should hold that future hostage to the demands of a few advertisers, no matter how lucrative those ads might be. I think we can have a great internet. We can have a better internet without surveillance-based advertising.
Well, first, I want to say thank you. Thanks for this. This is very valuable information in the book. In closing, how can the listeners around the world do whatever they can to protect their privacy as much as possible, given the encroachment from all these big data companies, the big business, the government, and whatnot? Are there steps that they could take that are easy and accessible that at least makes it a little harder and gives them a little more space and freedom?
Yeah. So let me answer that question at two levels, right? One, yeah, there are absolutely things you can do as a consumer, as a voter to make your life better. One, unfortunately, is to worry about this kind of stuff, to have good data security at your home, to try and patronize businesses and products that have a commitment to privacy. You know, you can use web browsers like DuckDuckGo, and there are others that are not Facebook or Google surveillance capitalist. But But the second level, I think I've read this book dozens of times, the book that said, you know, privacy is under threat. Here's some things you can do to make things better. These problems are not ones that can predominantly be solved by individuals acting alone. The scale and scope of the power difference between you as a consumer and Google is so great that you can't solve this problem by anything you can do yourself in a meaningful way. The way to solve this problem is through law, is to advocate for better data privacy rules, and better data privacy rules as a nonpartisan value, right? So the analogy that I often think of is, again, the Industrial Revolution produced industrialized food, and Upton Sinclair writes The Jungle, and it turns out sausage making is really horrifying, and meat is impure, or water is polluted. We use legal rules to make the food we eat and the water we drink safe for human consumption. And we did so by placing legal frameworks and incentives, and in some cases, criminal potential liability on companies. And we did that ultimately in a way that is not particularly partisan. I think we need to do that for privacy. Just as you can't, if you go into a restaurant, you can't figure out, you know, how has the vegetable been prepared? Were pesticides used? Is there E. coli in my broccoli? Are there worms in my ketchup? You can't do that on your own, no matter how hard you work. We should be able to trust that our digital environment is protective, that these companies are being loyal to us, and that there are legal rules in place that they put our best interests, not just engagement, but actually serving our needs first. And we can do that for privacy the way we did that for water and food and safe toys and auto emissions standards. It's going to take some work, but the Industrial Revolution has taken us 100 years to bring in check. It's a constant project. And I think the Information Revolution produces wonderful, wonderful things. But bringing the Information Revolution in check is itself going to be a long-term project. And privacy protection for human beings as humans, as citizens, and as consumers, privacy protection is going to have to be a meaningful and ongoing part of that project. If we care about things like developing our identities or having a democracy or being protected as consumers. That's why privacy matters.
You've been listening to the What Matters Most podcast, a 100% listener-supported program. If you feel inspired, please go to our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/whatmattersmost and join our family. So until the next time, stay inspired and in the light.